Good evening. Hope everyone's doing well in the post-Pesach. Hopefully we've winded down, but once we wind down from Pesach, then we gear up for other things. So, I'm excited to resume learning together, and I'm particularly excited about this topic. I'm glad it was requested. And I'm excited about it because it's we call Agadata the, I'll explain briefly what's included in that and, why it's included in the Talmud, which is overwhelmingly a legal code. But the reality is that, Agadata is even in yeshiva learning and the types of shiurim, at least that you find in yeshivas, they're kind of, at least in the standard curriculum and emphasis, kind of overlooked. Maybe not intentionally, not that they're not important, but you don't usually, in yeshiva, even if the Gemara has a Gadata, you usually the shiur is more on the halachic or analytical portions of the Talmud. I learned the hard way not to breeze through a Gadata and not pay attention. Remember when I was in the kollel at YU, so we'd have tests every once in a while. It was more the afternoon kollel was to cover more ground in the Gemara, but it's to make sure that you're keeping up. And I remember that one of the questions was a specific question. This is made by Herschel Schechter, a specific question about which Tana was it in this Agadata, which me and my chavrusa were praying. We just kind of fly through, so I learned the hard way. Don't disregard Agadata. I think more simple reason not to disregard it is because Chazal, the sages, included it. So if they included it, there was obviously a good reason for it. And there is little discussion. There are some places where you do find some discussion of this distinction between halacha and agada, but when you're learning Gemara, you don't have okay. Now this heading is agadata. This heading is halacha. But what are some basic categories of agadata? I say agadata meaning the non-legal portions of the Talmud. So there are some that are basically medrash. There are some examples in Maseches Megillah. You have a lot explaining the psukim and expounding exegesis on the verses in the Megillah. Now Daf Yomi is doing so. So also a lot of these are things that Rashi quotes on Chumash or on the Megillah. There, but similar to what you find in medrash, explaining, giving a little more detail, having some more homiletic interpretations of the Torah. What I think we'll focus on here, and some of these categories there are aspects of both, are stories of the sages, meaning the Talmud in general records conversations between the sages, but sometimes the Gemara will veer off into a story about the sages, about one sage, an event that happened, and they take different forms. Some of the stories are more related to the halachic topic that is being discussed, and sometimes it does, I don't want to say digress, but sometimes it really addresses new things that are not directly related to the topic, but And I'll give some context to what we're learning here by saying, see this, like, actually, you're learning brachos, you have a kriya shma and tefillah, and then you have a lot of agadata related to that. And a lot of it is not, directly related to the laws or interpretation of laws, but you can kind of see what it's trying to bring out, that it does, it's not totally detached from the legal portions. And then you have some stories that are, and this is the way many interpret it, Avraham ben Arambam has an explanation of Agadata there, kind of exaggerations. And we, with these stories, I think we could take them more literally, but some stories we'll have to see. How do we understand it? Are they meant to be taken literally? There are some stories you find that there's metaphors, that you even find humor, irony. So the Agadita takes these different forms. But basically, it's the non-legal, at least not directly legal portions of the Gemara. So I thought we're coming up to Lag BaOmer during the period of Sfira. So I thought it'd be worthwhile to take a look at Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva, he's not that he needs my endorsement, but he's one of my heroes. You even find different stages in his life. Certainly an extraordinary person. But, and I think this is one of the enjoyments of learning Agadita. There are famous standard commentaries on Agadita, like most famously the Marsha, Chidush HaAgados, is found in the back of the Gemara. You find others as well. But it's a little bit less, rigid as far as, the standard curriculum and looking at specific commentaries. And I think there's more room left for interpretation and looking at it and seeing what messages we ourselves can glean from them. And when you look at these stories that may be familiar, some of them are the, art scroll bedtime stories, but when you take a closer look, I think we see that it's not, the sages aren't just, telling stories for the sake of, we're dealing with legal things, and then we want, an intermission to make it a little more entertaining. But the stories bring out important values, and I think we'll see here. And I invite everyone to share their impressions of it. But I think there we could find an underlying message, and maybe even a critical message that is found in. Even in the things that on the surface we think are just stories. So I want to take a look at stories related to Rabbi Akiva, to the sage Hillel, and the overall theme, which we'll see, of access to Torah. Who gets to learn Torah? Is it possible to learn Torah if one doesn't start with a strong background? Are there financial barriers to Torah? And what does that mean? What are the sages trying to bring out in these different stories? So the story of Rabbi Akiva, mostly found in, there's more or less identical story found in Nidarim and in Ksubos and in Avos de Rabbi Nassan, the Bryce is related to Pirkei Avos. And there are actually some differences and perhaps some conflicts between them, but we get a basic picture of Rabbi Akiva. So one thing that we're told is, Rabbi Akiva started learning when he was 40, but what was his background until then? So the Gemara Pesachim, this is in source 1, he used to say, Shaisi Ama Aretz, that when I was in Ama Aretz, when I was in Ingdoremus, but generally when we see in Chazal first the Amaretz, it's generally people who are more antagonistic to Torah, not just people who don't have the knowledge. So when I was in Amaretz, mi ten li Talmud Chacham, v'nashkenu kachamor. That if I ever came across a Torah scholar, I would bite him like a donkey. Yeah, bring me a Torah scholar. I don't know if he literally bit them, but the point is he was antagonistic to them. There's clearly an element of resentment, of antagonism, and he certainly wasn't trying to, didn't sound like he was trying to become one of them, which he, of course, eventually did. So, I have to see, why is that? Why was he just, a bore? Was he just, an unrefined person? Or maybe we can see through some of the other stories, dealing with Rabbi Akiva, dealing with Hillel, maybe there is an underlying, perhaps, endorsement or explanation for why he had such an antagonistic attitude towards Torah scholars, and whether that contained a certain amount of validity. So we'll go through the biography of Rabbi Akiva. So what was the Avos de Rabbi Nassan, number 2? So what was his beginning? So we know he's 40 years old and wasn't learned at all. And one day, he was standing by a well, and he asked, who carved this stone? And they said, the water continually falls on it. They said to him, Akiva, have you not read? Do you not know Eov? And there's actually some commentary that, how ignorant was he? If, of course, don't you know this pasuk in Eov? So there is a little unclear how how ignorant he was. We do see in other places that he was learning aleph beis. So, but it's just an interesting point. So he said, "Don't you know, Avani Avinu Shachak Umayim, that don't you know that it says the water that stones were eroded by water?" So he drew a logical inference. He said, if the water, the gentle water, can carve the hard, then how much more so could words of Torah, which are as hard as iron, carve my heart of flesh and blood? So it's interesting, and I'm not sure that all the gaps are filled in from how he, either if he, at this point, he developed from this inspiration of the rock, from this person who is antagonistic to Torah scholars, who seemingly didn't have appreciation for Torah, and now it acknowledges the power of Torah. The words of Torah are like iron, and I want to learn. So at that point, he was inspired. He realized that Torah could be accessible to him, and he and his son went and learned by all of the scholars. Also, I'm not sure where the timeline is, where he had a son from before, or the son was from when he married the daughter of Kalba Savua, the Rachel, the wife of Rabbi Kiva. In the passages that talk about her, it doesn't mention them having a child. He was 40 years old, maybe he had a child, but he and his son went and learned Torah, and then it continues, I don't know if it all here, how he would go to different Torah scholars, and he was thirsty for Torah, and he progressed. So, another account of Rabbi Kiva's origins and what inspired him to learn Torah was his marriage. That there was a man, Kalba Savua, which is related to the words that Kalva, Kelev, Savua, the satiated. So Kalva Savua was a very wealthy man. He was a very generous man. And the Gemara says that whenever people were needy and would go to his house, they'd leave satiated. They'd come in like a dog hungry, and they would leave satiated. So his name is a play on words of that. So you see, he was a wealthy man, a generous man, but like is sometimes the case, not when it comes to his daughter. You know, not when you're marrying into the family. You can take care of people, but you marry into the family, you know, then you're not good enough. So, and then that's what happened. It says that the daughter of Kalba Savua, whose name was Rachel, saw Rabbi Akiva. He saw that he had positive qualities, and this is, again, there's a Gemara in Nedarim and also in Ksubas, so some minor details, some you're trying to fill them in, that he saw that he had, that the daughter of Kalba Savua, Rachel, saw that Rabbi Kiva was humble, that he had good qualities, and she said, if you, you know, if we get married, will you go learn Torah? And he agreed. So, but Kalba Savua is not happy about this, and he took a neder, he took a vow, that she shouldn't benefit from any of his property. She wouldn't inherit anything. She was on her own. And just to connect the legal portions of the Gemara to how it fits in, so in Nedarim, it deals with vows, and the Gemara's before talking about how one releases themselves from vows. And then you have this in that context. And actually, the Gemara in Ksubas, reporting a similar story, is going on the more legal portions of, you know, the husband's responsibilities to his wife, how much he has to attend to her. And you see from the story, clearly, in an unusual marriage, according to those standards, that they were away for 12 years or really for 24 years. So it does connect to the legal portions that precede it. So what happened? So they eloped. And Kalba Savua, when he heard, he made a nether that she couldn't benefit from his property. So they had absolutely nothing. They slept in a straw storage area, and she picked straw out of his beard. That's how desperate they were. And he said that if I had it, I was able to buy it for you, I'd give you a Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, which is a piece of jewelry. And when they really are having this conversation, had, you know, absolutely nothing, to the point where, you know, she's gathering straw from his beard, Eliyahu HaNavi appeared as a person and said, can you give me a little straw? My wife has just given birth, and we have nothing on which she could lie. So Rabbi Akiva told his wife, see, this man has even less than we do. So you see, the qualities that she saw in him were clearly evident, and this was before he went to learn. But he had a sense of compassion to help this person. And maybe this was Eliyahu Navi, maybe it was even a test of his character and commitment. So she said to him, go learn. So then he went before Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Yeshua for 12 years. And after he came home, so there was a Rasha, a wicked person who, you know, you can imagine what people thought, and understandably so, that here she was, she had absolutely nothing. Her husband has been away for 12 years. You know, it's not so simple. It's not, and I think that this connection to the legal portions that it goes on about the husband's responsibility to his wife, it's not really the standard prescription for marriage. This is an unusual case, but you know, perhaps the fact that it's going on that portion is telling us this is not, you know, don't try this at home. You know, this is, you know, not the standard marriage, but there are, you know, extraordinary people. And you see that she was not only willing with complete permission, complete enthusiasm, told him to learn and told him to learn more. So, but this person in the community, this wicked person, this agitator said, that, you know, your father was right. You're being ridiculous. First, Rabbi Akiva is not like you. He's not from your level in society. Rabbi Akiva was also descendant of converts, and unfortunately, converts are, you know, can be discriminated against. So he's not of your stock. So your father did the right thing, and also he left you like a widow for all these years. So she said, if he would listen to me, he would learn for another 12 years. So Rabbi Akiva heard this, and he said, since she has permitted me to go, she wants me to go, and he turned back. There's some discussion why, you know, he didn't, you know, say hi and, you know, stay for a little bit. So the thing is, Chaim Shmulevitz says that there's an idea that you know, Torah, when you learn Torah, when you're immersed in Torah, it's like a pot on the stove. There's a certain momentum and a certain enthusiasm that goes, and then you take it off, it may not be the same. Again, I don't think he was saying in practice, don't, you know, if you're 12 years away from your wife for whatever reason, not to stop and say hello, but it brings out this point. So he went back, and he came back with, then 12 years later, he came with 24,000 students. Everyone went out to greet him. She also went, and the same agitator said, And where are you going? You know, you see, he's coming back. You're, as he said, you're living like a widow. You have nothing. You're not respected here. And Rabbi Akiva is coming back with all these students, a very distinguished person. So she says, you know, don't give me that, because she quotes, a pasuk, Yodei Tzadik Nefesh Behemto, that the righteous person knows, not that she's saying she's an animal, but she knows who he gets his support from. He knows who's helping him out. You know, don't tell me not to go and greet him. So she came to present herself before Rabbi Akiva, but his students, and I thought that, you know, maybe this does reflect a shortcoming in Midos. So you say that Rabbi Akiva's students, how would they have, you know, not acted with covet for one another. So I think the following does show that, you know, maybe they weren't as careful and focused on Midos as they should be. So she came in front of Rabbi Akiva, but his students tried to call me Dachan LaRabbanan. The rabbis pushed her away. So he says a famous line, important line, something that is very true, that husbands should recognize her of their wives, that vice versa. He says, Shali v'shalachem shalahi. What's mine and what's yours belongs to her. That the Torah that I've learned, the Torah that you've learned from me, it's all a result of her mesiras nefesh, of her sacrifice, of her sending me to learn Torah, her encouragement for me to learn Torah. Everything. So leave her alone. She deserves more respect, because everything that I have and you have are really hers, are really to her credit. So now, Kalba Savua hears that this Gavur Rabba, this important person, has come to town. So he says, Amar Ezel Gavay, I'll go to him, and Efshar the Mefar Nidroy. Maybe he'll nullify my vow. So I wonder what he's thinking there, if he's had some regret about what he did, about cutting his daughter off. And he sees that it's Rabbi Akiva. So Aslak Abay Amar Le, Adaita the Gavur Rabba mean Nadart. So Rabbi Akiva asks him a question, and we do see hints of the halakha that's being discussed, that sometimes a neder, a vow, can be uprooted if there was some mistake at the time of the vow. If you didn't realize either the effects or all of the circumstances you may encounter. So had you known this, so Rabbi Akiva is ready to consider releasing him of this vow. So he said, had you known that I would have become a Gavur Rabba, that I'd become an important person, would you have made this vow? Would you have cut your daughter off and totally disassociated with her? So he says, Amar lo, afilu perek echad, afilu halacha achas. He's like, of course, if he knew even one chapter, one chapter of Chumash, even one halacha, I never would have done that. It gives you a sense of how little Rabbi Akiva knew. And it also speaks to his wife's perception and appreciation of what he could become. But he's saying it's not that he had to be who he is now for me to accept him. If he knew anything, I would never have done it. So at that point, I think Marther continues to say, actually, Rabbi Akiva became very wealthy after this, fell on his face, and Rabbi Akiva released him his vow and gave him half his assets, and then Rabbi Akiva had these different business ventures. So he turned out he went from a pauper to a pretty comfortable person. But we see, and we'll see this with Hillel as well, how poverty, or lack of means can be a barrier to accessing Torah. Clearly it's a theme here. In addition to, not having the education and not being in the same station in society, they were poor, and he learned Torah despite that. And that obviously Rabbi Nassan in number 5 in the second side says that Rabbi Akiva is an example to everyone, that a person is going to be asked, why didn't you learn Torah? And they'll say, because I was poor, I was trying to support myself, trying to support my family. But they'll be told, Rabbi Akiva was exceptionally poor and destitute. They'll say, well, we had children. He said, Rabbi Akiva had sons and daughters. But they'll say that it's because of the merit of his wife, Rachel. Not everyone has a wife like that. But we see that there are challenges to learning Torah in poverty, but there's also an obligation to learn Torah regardless of one's circumstances. And we see this in both directions in the next Gemara in Yuma, which tells the story of Hillel. So the Gemara says that basically it quotes three groups of people and says that in whatever group you fit into, you're not going to be able to say that you aren't able to learn Torah because there's someone who is in the same situation as you who is able to overcome the challenge and become great in Torah. Says Tana Rabbanan, Ani Va'ashev Rasha Bain Ladin. A pauper, a wealthy person, and a wicked person, meaning someone who has a strong Yetzer Hara, will come on the day of judgment. And La'ani Omrim, they'll say to the poor person, Mimad Lola Asakta B'Torah. Why weren't you involved in Torah? And he'll say, Ani Ayisi, I was poor, bitarid bebizonosai, and I was busy and worried about my sustenance. So he'll say to him, Hum Ani Ayisi Yosem Hillel, were you poorer than Hillel? And now it tells a story of just how poor Hillel was. So it said about Hillel that every day he would earn a trepik, a half a dinar, and he would give half of it to the guard at the base medrash. So the base medrash had a guard posted outside, they charged admission, and he would give half of his daily earnings in order to enter the base medrash and learn Torah. one day he wasn't able to work, and he went to the base medrash. He didn't have any money, so the guard wouldn't let him in. So what did he do? He didn't say, I'll come back tomorrow, but he climbed up and sat on the skylight so he could hear words of Torah, Dibra Lekim Chayim, from Shmayev and Aftalion. And it happened that it was Friday, and the snow fell on him. And then at the break of dawn, so Shmaya said to Avtalion, usually it's light, as it's a cloudy day. So they looked up and they saw that, you know, that, and it's in the bedtime stories book, but it comes from here, and the hill is on the roof. And so they looked up, and then they found that he was there. So they took off the snow, washed him off, and put him by a fire. And they said that this man is certainly worthy for us to desecrate the Sabbath for. So they saw his commitment to learning Torah, even though he wasn't able to get in. He couldn't afford the fee of admission. So how does this reflect on the system, on who has access to Torah? Do you think that Chazal, by including this, are saying that this was a good system and Hillel just through difficulties, wasn't able one day to do it, or, and the Marsha says this, and that I think it's very compelling, that this story was told as a critique of the bars to barriers to admission to learn Torah because of financial situations. And the Marsha at the bottom says that, it's complex, and this is not simple, and there's a balance. So on one hand, why did they have a guard at the door? Why did they charge a fee? It's because you need, in kemach in Torah, there's no flour, there's no food, there's no money, there's no Torah. You need money to keep things going, to keep the electricity going, or keep the fire burning. And there's that's a legitimate thing, that was one that aspect and one legitimate reason that they had someone at the door. But he also says maybe he could also understand this like the Gemara in Brachos tells about Rabban Gamliel, who would also place a guard by the door and would say that anyone who wasn't Toklo Shabaro, that his inside wasn't like his outside, a student who doesn't mean the high standards, not the perfect student, then they're not going to be admitted. And then it tells a story which actually also touches on the gaps between the haves and the have-nots, and the lack of awareness of the leadership. That's the story in Brachos. It says Rabbi Gamliel's policy, and then he got into a fight with Rabbi Yeshua, so he goes to his house, and he sees that, he has soot all over, they're living in such squalor, and the other comments that, he was shocked, but that he, who was the leading sage, didn't realize how the other half lived. So again, I think you see a critique of even the sages, even leaders, even leading Torah scholars, not having an awareness of how other people live and setting up high barriers to learning Torah. And so this is that this is a similar type of dynamic. And also saw from Professor Yonah Frankel that there's also perhaps a symbolism here, that they woke up and they saw in the morning that the base medrash was dark, and the symbolism could be saying that the more people who are there learning, the more people who have access to Torah, that provides illumination. And when we prevent people from accessing Torah, when we put up you know, barriers that are so high. So the base medrash and the institution where Torah is learned is darkened. I mean, the Torah learning, places of Torah learning are enhanced by more people who are there. And this could be thinking back to the very beginning of why Rabbi Akiva, when he was an ignoramus, he would say, "You want to, you know, bite a Talmud Chacham like a donkey," because it seemed to be the dynamic that maybe the Torah scholars, as knowledgeable as they were, as pious as they were, didn't have, you know, basic respect for those who were not as knowledgeable, didn't have the same opportunities, and that creates a resentment towards Torah scholars. And it's not so clear that this is meant to reflect negatively on Rabbi Akiva. That maybe this is the beginning of showing the broader point that Torah scholars, leaders of the community, have to have an awareness of everyone and have to make Torah accessible to the haves, the have-nots, and when that's not done, and when maybe it's not even not done intentionally, but when there's a lack of awareness and we lose sight of it, and we're kind of only focused on, you know, the inner circle, on the elite, so that creates antagonism. And when those who don't have, you know, who don't have the same background, realize, have some indication, maybe their own inspiration, that they can also achieve, so they are turned on to Torah. They're not inherently negative to Torah. It's not something that's not fixable. But perhaps the treatment of the elite towards those who aren't part of the elite causes antagonism, which we see even from someone who is so great and so sensitive like Rabbi Akiva. So, hope this is an introduction to some of the ways that Agadita is brought out in the Gemara, reflecting on some of the legal portions that are being discussed, but also not just telling the stories for an intermission, but the sages we're trying to bring out. And sometimes it's not so clear on the surface, but when you focus and dig a little bit deeper, you see that they were trying to teach us lessons. They were trying to send a message, and they even had the integrity to reflect on their own behavior and their own conduct. So we see of course, Chazal were very holy people, and we see that they had a willingness to reflect on the system that they were part of, that they were the elite within, and here they brought out values that they focused on. We see even this with the story of Rabban Gamliel, how then when Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah took over, then they brought in more benches, they allowed more people to learn Torah. So we see in different places this development and this reflection on exclusion and the end result, the improvement being exclusion. I'm not sure that we see, there was a place that included people, and now we're not going to. I don't know if that's, you know, the model, but we see in different places with different figures those values and that lesson and that development of exclusion to a heightened awareness to include others, and these should be lessons for us to make Torah accessible, to know that Torah is accessible to us, to realize that we're not exempt from learning Torah, even though we're in difficult situations. The Gemara in Yuma also says that the wealthy will also be held accountable. It tells of Rabbi Elazar ben Charsom, we had all these business ventures, but would still find time to learn Torah in any free time he had. So even the wealthy people have challenges as well. You know, whatever situation people are in, there are always challenges, some bigger than others. But I think it's also the lesson there. But this is an introduction. We can spend a couple more weeks about this, looking closely at the lessons that Chazal are trying to teach us that are just as relevant now as they were in the times of the Gemara. So hopefully we can take that with us.